This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. My name is George Carlin, and I am a professional comedian, as opposed to the kind you run into at work all day long. It's nice being a comedian. There are certain advantages, naturally, and a few disadvantages. There are some drawbacks to being a comedian. No one on death row has ever said, "Before I die, I want to talk to a comedian." You ever hear anyone at the scene of an accident say, "Quick, call a comedian, for God's sakes!" But it would be kind of fun at an accident to push your way through the crowd and say, "May I be of help? I'm a professional comedian." And sooner or later, at least once in your life, when the policeman says to you, "What are you, a comedian?"
George Carlin has been a comedian since the early 60s. And while early on he earned a devoted following for his hippy-dippy weatherman and other bits, his humor has become decidedly more political and more serious. Carlin draws upon three sources for his stand-up: the little world of everyday life, the big world of politics, and the English language. Back in the 70s, his now famous "seven words you can never say on television" routine led to a landmark Supreme Court ruling which upheld an FCC ban on indecent material. But that far from ended Carlin's career. He's released 18 comedy albums, won 2 Grammys, and has had 10 HBO comedy specials. This year, George Carlin turned 60, and he's just written a book called Brain Droppings. George Carlin knew as a kid that he wanted to be a performer, either a musician or a comedian or a DJ. He got his first radio job while in the Army, and I was curious if he felt that radio offered him a certain kind of freedom.
When I started in radio, I was a top 40 disc jockey. I was a teenager, late teenager at the time. Top 40 was just beginning, so was rock and roll, so it was an auspicious time to be a young DJ playing the music that you were making out to that same night.
Right.
And promising a girl you'd play a song for her and, and dedicate it to
That's
her.
That's a lot of power back then.
That got you a lot of things. So I don't know the answer to your question, except that radio has changed so much. And even what used to be a wonderfully free form, that you used to call it underground radio, the FMs, they're all run by these corporate consultants now. And it's, you know, it's everything in this whole world, much less country, is just sort of one big corporate formula now, you know, big logo.
Were you hoping to change that? Because certainly your comedy has always been very political. You've always gone after things like organized religion or, big business.
Yeah. No, never hoping to change anything. It's too enjoyable the way it is. I mean, I just...
What would you laugh about, right?
Yeah. And I'm not a crusader. I'm not a person who... I'm not a reformer. I don't care about these things. I've really divorced myself from this species a long time ago and from this culture, so I have no emotional attachment, and therefore I have a really artistic freedom to be fully critical without worrying about some issue that I'm interested in. I noticed a lot of these comedians, this happened to me about, I guess, in the last 6 to 8 years, that a lot of political or social comedians seem to have implicitly in their work this plea that if only we could all get together and hold hands and chant in the park and vote for certain bills, everything would be all right. And I don't believe that at all. I don't think anything's ever going to be all right. I think we have all the wrong things in front of us now. So I just sort of root for the demise of the civilization, but in a slow and entertaining fashion so that I can enjoy it and laugh at it.
So when you say you don't care, did you have to go through a process of learning not to care? Did you care once?
Well, we all have a period, at least in our lives, some are more extended than others, of thinking that we might save the world. What we find out, some of us find out, is that the world will not cooperate in this idea. Some continue to bang their heads against the wall forever. Some people work different ways. Some are in the courts using their skills with the law to change things. Other people get into public life, and some are in the street hurling firebombs. And some of us, even when I, at that point when I did sort of have a stake in it, try to work by just letting our ideas float down and see what happens.
What do you hope that your comedy, though, accomplishes? Is it just to make people laugh?
That's really That's really the only goal I have, is to entertain them and to sing my song. The first feeling for doing any of this sort of thing, I believe, whether it's playing the piano or painting pictures or writing poetry, is that you have something to express, an ineffable, something you can't quite put your finger on. So you you say, hey, folks, look at this. Watch me. Wait till you see what I do. And whether you're passing your paintings around or you're reciting things from a stage, it's essentially a show-off situation. Then I think, secondly, if what you have to offer has some value or use to another person because of their particular circumstance, then that's a dividend, and that's nice, and that's good. Right. But you can never begin by aiming for that. You can't say, I have a message here, folks, because then you're dead. You might as well just, you might as well write newspaper articles.
Well, have you ever wanted to be popular, to be liked, to be quoted? I mean, all the stuff that comes with being on the stage and being well-known for being on the stage.
Well, I think what I wanted to be was a famous person. I mean, I think that was at the beginning of my aspirations to be. I wrote it up once in a humorous fashion. I said, all I ever wanted to be was a really famous, well-known celebrity that everyone recognized.
Right.
And if
you
I could,
did that, right?
Yes, and if I could be that, then I'd worry about how I did it. But it was always a case of, having some little song to sing and wanting people to not just, they say that the one definition of success is doing something you love, doing it well, and being recognized for it. So when they pat you on the head and say, isn't he a clever little boy? My, that is so clever. You really puff up, and it draws you to this procedure, of entertaining because you feel the approval.
Well, what's dangerous and exciting about humor, of course, is the nastiness to it. There's that famous, I never know who says this, but, you slip on a banana peel, that's comedy. I slip on a banana peel, that's tragedy. The idea that someone else's misfortune can be used for humor. Do you find that fine line?
Well, my aim is usually against, there are so many different things I try to do. You mentioned the three areas I draw from.
Right.
So there's innocence and whimsy and a childlike approach to the world in some of my work. There is also a very adult seasoned skepticism, which some people call cynicism. Some people see it as anger. I see it as a real discontent with things and a feeling of betrayal on the part of my fellow humans. I really think this species had a chance at one time with a number of great gifts it was given, including this marvelous brain. And we've wound up seeking salad shooters and sneakers with lights in them and mergers and stock options and all of these sort of superficial things. Necessary, I understand, but superficial really in the big scheme. And so So I'm very disappointed in this, and it comes out as a kind of anger. It's an impatience. And so I don't worry much. I don't have many individual targets, because what I did was I didn't do this intentionally. I discovered about myself one day there, somewhere along the way, that I'm very good about individuals. I don't have a whole lot of complaints to make about people one by one. And when I meet them, I connect fairly well with them. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, if I can get a little grand with this, I often say you can look in the eyes of a person and see the hologram for the whole human race because of all the potential we have. But then I see people in groups. When I see these individuals clotting, when I see 3, 5, 10, 15, 150, whatever it is, they start having little hats and little armbands, and they have slogans and marching songs and a little list of people they don't like. And it gets ugly because groups rob the individual of the beauty, that people surrender their beauty to the group mind.
So you're not a misanthrope?
No, I'm not, because in one by one, I think men, and I use that in the old-fashioned large M sense that I don't think has to be changed, are wondrous creatures. But it's when they get together and they say, what do you want to do tonight? That's when it gets dangerous.
Well, actually, the last little brain dropping in your book here is called Killer Comic, and this is sort of what we're talking about. You write comedies. Nature has two sides. Everyone wants a good time and a couple of laughs. And, of course, the comic wants to be known as a real funny guy. But the language of comedy is fairly grim and violent. It's filled with punchlines, gags, and slapsticks. After all, what does a comic worry about the most? Dying. He doesn't want to die.
I don't
want
to die. Boy, I was dying out there. It was a morgue. It was like death out there. But the interesting twist on it is, if he succeeds, if he doesn't die out there, and he does well, he can turn around and say, I killed them.
Yeah, that's right.
I killed him.
So this is what, warfare? I mean,
yeah, it's life and death, because it is a high wire act, stand-up comedy. You're out there alone. The only thing you have going for you is you're holding the microphone, and you have these ideas in your head that you've memorized, presumably. And you're only as good as the last few moments. You know, a singer can wait 3, 4, 5 minutes for approval every time, and they're going to get some polite applause, regardless if people even didn't like the song. But the comedian is depending on a spontaneous reaction, which people can't fake, and it has to happen every 5 or 10 seconds. And once you miss 3 or 4 of them in a row, the audience knows that they begin to smell it, and it makes everyone uncomfortable, and it's harder to dig out.
And what do they smell? A dying carcass?
I mean, yeah, the fear. The flop sweat and the embarrassment of someone else doing poorly in public. They feel that.
I read that early on in your career, perhaps one of the first times you actually did stand up was before an audience of nobody.
Yeah, down in Baltimore, I was down in Baltimore. I was on a curve, sitting on a curve. There was a club called the Blue Dog Inn, and it was brand new. It was a brand new club. The guy opened it on the July 4th weekend, which is not very bright.
Everyone leaves town,
everyone's
right?
Everyone's at the shore. Sure. Down the shore. You ain't going down the shore. So, and he didn't do any publicity or PR work or anything. And the place was empty at 8:30. The guy looked at me and he said, okay, showtime. And I said, yeah, well, nobody's here, you know. And he said, I know, but in case someone comes in, I want them to know there's a show going on. So I did the show for a waiter and a waitress and a bartender. And it was a very quick show.
I bet it was.
Very quick, yeah. About 12 minutes shorter than usual.
I read that you really admire Danny Kaye.
Well, as a child, I did. I admired that vocal facility and his face, the faces he made, the accents and things. I thought he was terrific. But as is true in life, all things are not what you think. And when I was a little boy, I collected autographs. I would go around to the theaters in New York after school and to the radio networks, and I knew the times of the shows and when the guys were coming and leaving. So I waited around the Roxy. It was either the Roxy or Radio City. I think it was the Roxy. For Danny Kaye, who was really, if I had anyone I could call an idol or a hero, and I don't like those words necessarily, but they're useful, he would be the one. And I waited in the rain. I was the only one at the stage door. It wasn't like there was a crowd there. Waited maybe an hour or something, and he pulled up in a taxi and just went right in past me. And I don't do that. I don't sign. Bing, you know. So that took care of that.
Right.
That took care of Danny Kaye.
Right.
And he's always been suspect in my mind with this UNICEF stuff. I see him with kids. I say, how much can he care about those kids? How much of that is for his own ego and to make himself look good? And how much does he care about those kids? So you have to look carefully at things.
Well, are you careful coming and going places if people want your autograph?
I don't think I've ever had to turn anyone down except if I was in an extreme hurry and I really had to make a plane or something. But I've always been pleasant about it if I had to, and it's very rare that I do.
Do you like doing it?
I do. I think it's a part of the deal. Mm-hmm. I think once you stand up in front of people and say, look at me, well, whatever attention comes your way, you've asked for it. I don't think you have the right to then get surly and be saying to people, I don't have time for these people. Can't we go in the back door and just skip all of this? I don't think that's part of the deal.
And the autograph is a piece of you. That's what people want.
Yeah, it's a connection. And it's a big moment for the person who's asking. You know, you might sign 10 of them a day or more or whatever, and that person may get one autograph a year or maybe one in a life, not even care about any others than yours. So they're going to tell 100 people about it. And if nothing else, for your own self, you know, interest, you want to have him tell a good story to 100 people, not a crappy story.
George Carlin is my guest. He's just written a new book called Brain Droppings. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is comedian George Carlin. He's just written a book called Brain Droppings. Well, I know you went to a Catholic school.
Yeah.
And I wonder how the nuns thought about actor, comedian, impersonator, radio announcer, trumpet player. Was that what they had in mind for you?
Well, it was a very unusual school. It was an experimental Catholic school started in the 1930s in New York called Corpus Christi. It was a diocesan school, one of the parishes, a parish school like all the others, but very different. We had a pastor, George Ford, who wanted to experiment. We were physically situated right across the street from Columbia University, in particular, Teachers College on 121st. And that's where John Dewey expounded all of his theories on progressive education. Well, Father Ford was a devotee of John Dewey's theories and wanted to have the diocese experiment with one school where things would be different and it wouldn't be like those discipline mills. So in my Catholic grammar school, we had special nuns from Wisconsin, Cincinnati Dominicans. He insisted that they all be women who had received master's degrees from secular institutions. He didn't want them coming out of Catholic universities. He wanted secularly trained nuns. We had no capital punishment. That's interesting. No corporal punishment. They couldn't touch you. They didn't want to. They were too nice. And there were no grades or marks of any kind. We had no report cards in school.
Wow, lucky you.
Yeah, it was wonderful because there was none of this artificial competition with other people. We did have tests at the end of the year that you were graded on.
Were you a good student?
I was good. I mean, I grasped material very quickly, and then I was a bad student. I mean, I was good at the work. Yeah, I was a disruptive influence. And the other thing about the school was that all the desks were movable. It wasn't that grid pattern of bolted down desks. They were movable. And that's kind of a metaphor for the mobility of the mind that they gave us, because we had different arrangements of desks every couple of weeks. You had different little, we called them neighbors, these are your new neighbors. And everything we did in school was open to discussion, all the lessons. And we were audited by these doctoral candidates from the Teachers College at Columbia who had heard of this experiment. And all through my 8 grades of grammar school, we had adults, civilians, standing at the back of the room watching what we did, which we thought was the norm.
Well, it must have been a rude awakening.
Yeah, to get to the brothers and priests in first year high school.
Right.
It's one of the reasons I left school.
Yeah, you left school in what grade?
After ninth grade. I had nine full years, and then I said, that's it. You're not teaching what I want. I'll see you later.
And what did you do after that? Ninth grade? How old were you?
Ninth grade,
like
I was to quit school, you have to be 16.
Okay.
So I went for 6 months to a public school where I didn't attend a single day. I just played hooky for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Got to be 16 and quit. Worked for a year at Western Union in an office called Plant and Engineering as a junior clerk as a 17-year-old, and then went in the Air Force, because my plan was to use the Air Force to accelerate my life, to get my draft obligation out of the way, get the GI Bill, learn to be a disc jockey. That was my plan. Get to be a DJ, and then they can't stop me.
You were a planner.
Anal, from the word go.
Have you always cared about language and words? I mean, even as a kid,
yeah.
and wanting people to use language in a meaningful way?
Well, I don't know. That second part is, and I don't even know if that describes me now. It's more like a critical side of my nature to point out mistakes, especially when they're made by people who are speaking for a living, you know, the news media.
Right.
You would look for a good example there. When you don't get it, it's more fun to attack them. I don't bother individuals about their speech. But my mother always, let's bring over the dictionary. Let's look that up. One time I came home, I used to bring her newspaper, her World Telegram and Sun in New York. I used to give her newspaper when she'd come home from work. And I gave her the newspaper once, and she said, "Oh, thank you. I'll peruse this and, whatever." So I said, "Peruse, what does that mean, peruse?" She said, "Well, let's look it up." So I looked it up, and then the next night when I gave her newspaper, I said, "Here, Mom, peruse this newspaper." And she said, "Well, I'll give it a cursory glance." And I was right back to the dictionary.
Oh,
so that was
great.
The practice at our house.
That's great. Did you have funny parents?
They were both very funny. I didn't know my father. He actually was the national advertising manager of the Philadelphia Bulletin for a while before he went to New York and became the same thing at the New York Sun. But and my mother managed the New York office of the Philadelphia Bulletin, and that's how they met. He was a salesman who would come up to New York to make national sales, and she was running that office in New York. So that's how they met. They're both very funny, gifted, both had that Irish gift of gab and that great sense of humor. And could tell a story. He was in fact, he was a well-known public speaker in his era. He won a lot of awards for public speaking.
But you weren't close.
He was asked to leave early because he couldn't metabolize ethanol. We saw that he had trouble metabolizing ethanol, and it turned him into a bully. So we packed our little stuff and went.
We meaning you and your mom.
And my brother. I was 2 months old. He was 5 years. She went out a window, down the fire escape, and through the backyards with an infant in her arms. Isn't it dramatic? And we ran away to the country.
Do you read poetry? And the reason I
don't. But finish the question.
I mean, the reason I ask that is that reading about you and certainly knowing your work is that you use language so carefully. Mm-hmm. I know you take a lot of time to craft the
yes.
kind of comedy yeah. that you do, and the kind of defiance that you have, the kind of political feelings that you have as well, are kinds that I have found with really good poets. Mm-hmm. They are a defiant group of
yeah,
people, and
yes.
they care deeply about each and every word that they use.
Yes.
And it reminded me of you to some degree.
Yeah. No, I've never been drawn to poetry. What I experience is impatience with it,
mm-hmm.
and a certain impatience that it's not as clear as I'd like it to be. You know, I don't want to engage in the detective story. I don't want to try to
just
figure out what they
tell
meant.
Me, right?
And of course, you don't have to know what they meant either. I mean, mm-hmm. poetry should just sound right, the meter and the rhythms and the choices of words. I can enjoy hearing poetry better than reading it, probably.
Comedian George Carlin, he's got a new book, Brain Droppings. I'm Marty Moscoene, and this is Fresh Air.